This is part two of a two-part interview with Lieutenant Colonel John Howells, retired, who was Secretary of the Museum of the New South Wales Lancers at Parramatta, where this interview took place. The project is Horses in Inner Sydney, Oral History Project. The date is the 11th of October 2007, and the interviewer is Margot Beasley.
When the war broke out,
World War One.
This is 1914. We had an interesting situation. The Australian Defence Act in 1903 had been set up with no provision for our soldiers to serve overseas. Under the terms of the British regulations that applied at the time, as soon as Australian soldiers went overseas, they fell under British command. And there'd been some pretty nasty experiences during the Boer War. I suppose most people would know about the Morant incident, where basically Morant and what's the other guy's name from Bathurst had been basically judicially murdered on the basis that they sort of killed Boer prisoners, and I'm afraid they had. There was no question about that. But the reasoning behind it had nothing to do with that. It was making an example of them to solve a British political problem rather than anything else. The worst incident had been with the 5th Victorian Mounted Rifles, where there'd been an incident under extremely poor British leadership where a camp had been attacked and hadn't been defended properly, and it was the leadership that had caused the problem. Soon after that, a couple of young troopers had been overheard by British officers saying something along the lines that if I had to go and serve with the guy who'd caused this problem, I'd prefer to be dead. Where's that effect? It's well written up. The three young soldiers were actually sentenced to death. They weren't killed. Kitchener actually was bright enough to step in that case. But those kinds of incidents had left some pretty bad tastes. So when our army was formed, there was no provision for them to go overseas. So when we hit 1914, they were faced with a dilemma. It would have been fairly easy just to, as had most other Commonwealth nations, just to say, righto, well, we will amend our Defence Act and we will allow our army to serve overseas. But there were a couple of problems. The current army from 1912, as a result of Kitchener's visit, was fleshed out with conscripts. And so there was there was what was called the Universal Service Obligation, lasted until 1929. And so if they took the existing units, then they were going to send Australian conscripts overseas. And that was a bit of a concern in terms of selling the war to the Australian public. And there were plenty of volunteers. So what they did was they formed a new army. They said, we're going to form this army, eventually called the Australian Imperial Force, mainly because they wanted three letters that sounded good. And the guys in the current armed forces were allowed to resign and join. Now, of 7th Light Horse New South Wales Lancers, regimental headquarters, A and B squadron equivalent, which was, and there were eventually to be four squadrons, another two squadrons, left and joined the unit that was formed in Sydney, which was the 1st Australian Light Horse. Two squadrons at that point were taken from other young men who joined. There were subsequently other New South Wales Light Horse units formed, and of course New South Wales Infantry and all the rest of that. They went and fought in Gallipoli and in Palestine very successfully. Interestingly enough, there were New South Wales Light Horsemen. They came from in and around Wagga, etc., Wagga and to the south. But they served with Victorian units because there were only, on the Western Front, this is the front, France, there were only Victorian Light Horse, just the way it happened. Two squadrons from the 4th Light Horse, the original 4th Light Horse, and the 13th Light Horse became the divisional cavalry regiments, or not divisional, divisional cavalry squadrons, they were called cavalry regiments. The two from 4th Light Horse formed a regiment with the Otago Mounted Rifles, so they became an ANZAC Corps Cavalry Regiment. So that, and during the war, you had the guys who were in the original units, the militia, still continued, and the conscription still continued. It wasn't conscription to fight overseas. And that continued right through the war, and those guys were given patrol duties around Sydney, around vital water supplies, power stations, that sort of thing, and they used their horses for those patrol duties. They weren't, of course, armed with lances at this point. They were just light horsemen, and they didn't have swords. They just had rifles and their light horse uniform, and that's what they did. They patrolled in and around Sydney. So you had, right through the war, these horsemen patrolling until the latter stage.
So they've been a really more or less constant presence.
A constant presence right the way through. Mm. Toward the end, of course, once it was sort of the latter portion of after Villers-Bretonneux, after they had turned the Germans, you gradually had this fall off there, although they were still conscripting right the way through. At the end of the war, the units from overseas came home and were disbanded. The horses that they had overseas had not been their own horses. They were initially, but the army had bought them.
So the army owned them.
The army owned them.
And what was the fate of those horses?
Well, they were left there, except for one. And that was all around quarantine. So, and as with the Boer War, the horses were left there. The horses were owned by the army there. It hadn't been the militia training. You joined the army with your horse, and it was your horse, and you were paid for it. Once you went into the war, the army bought your horse.
So by the end of World War One. Cars were starting to be a bit of a presence.
A bit of a presence. And when they came back, they initially there was a bit of a difficulty getting back into the militia training because these guys had fought the war to end all wars, of course. A lot of the guys who had been overseas were people who didn't necessarily see themselves as full-time soldiers or part-time soldiers. A militia training requires a different mindset. You've got to balance your family and being your family there. These guys had been away full-time as soldiers. Not all of them translated. So you didn't sort of have this huge number of people. There'd been a bit of a problem. There were putting all those guys back into the workforce caused quite a bit of a difficulty after World War One. They did a lot better after World War Two, actually. But for the most part, the militia training was in doldrums for a couple of years. About 1921, they started to get it all together. The commanding officer here was a dentist. A.J. Mills, who commanded the 15th Light Horse in the desert, and they got a core of good officers out of from World War One, plus other young volunteers as officers and NCOs, and young soldiers again who just wanted to do this thing. They'd lost their black plumes. They even lost their badges for many years. The light horse in the desert had fought with emu plumes, which came from Queensland, and they fought under the Commonwealth badge, the Australian badge for the bayonets poking out. And when they were reformed after the war, that's how they were. So all the badges were black. They were the Commonwealth horse badge that they were. Stayed that way through and gradually increased in size. There were starting to be some difficulties with recruiting in the Sydney area because of the congestion more so than anything. Horses were still used, but not as personal transport in the city anymore. Young men at this point would be more likely to have a bicycle or go by train, tram, like the tram.
So a horse longer an essential.
The tramway network at that point was very good. Well, it was taken away, yes. I suppose there were reasons, but they were sold to PUP in the 1950s. But it was good public transport, so not every lad owned a horse. And generally, it was only those who owned a horse who would belong to the light horse. But horses were still used for every form of transport, every form of working in and around the city. And there were still guys who joined the light horse with their horses. There were more, had a tendency, Parramatta was sort of out, so there were more out there with horses. Windsor Richmond was still totally rural, they were horses. And at this stage, the regiment also stretched down to Bury down the south. And so they had their horses. 1929, you had some interesting stuff, and it was about the Depression. They ceased universal service, so they stopped the conscription at then. They couldn't afford it anymore. They did the strangest thing. They decided that they couldn't pay the soldiers. They actually stopped, instead of doing it, but up until this point you were doing sort of an annual camp a couple of weeks a year. They stopped doing that. What they did was they went and did a couple of long bivouacs.
Because it was cheaper, was it?
Yeah, because they couldn't afford to do the other training. And all the other training was done by people that are coming in and just doing their administration, etc. The weirdest thing they did was they decided that because they couldn't afford to pay them, they would give them a nice-looking uniform, and so therefore they'd all want to join because of the nice-looking uniform. And we haven't got any examples here, but we've got them in the other thing there. But a uniform.
Did that work?
Not really.
I suppose when people were poor, though, like in the Depression, if there was a...
Yeah.
It would have encouraged some people, I guess.
I suppose it did, and it was a nicer-looking uniform. They had the cavalry guys, by this stage, they had a maroon collar.
Smart looking.
Yeah, and silver buttons, and they brought back regimental badges with the, and they amalgamated the first with the what had been the Illawarra Light Horse, the 21st. So they became the first 21st Light Horse. The badge at this stage, the original badge after they became the first Australian Light Horse had a bar across it. The number of the regiment and the name of the regiment across it. And again, they had that with first 21st Light Horse and this silver badge. And they continued to train during the years of the Depression. Sometimes, though, it was very, very minor, sort of a couple of weekends a year. It was all they could afford to do, and many of the soldiers were doing their training without pay. It was about this time, of course, you had the influence of the New Guard.
Yes, and one famous character.
Yes, one De Groot, of course.
Captain De Groot, people who don't know, who's famous for slicing the ribbon on the Harbour Bridge.
Slicing the ribbon on the Harbour Bridge. The interesting thing here was that, and it's not well documented in terms of how it worked, the New Guard was only a New South Wales institution. It didn't spread to anywhere else. Campbell had been a lieutenant colonel in the First World War, and he was the leader. They called him our leader. Der Führer, El Cordillo, El Deuce, all that sort of thing. But he was our leader. He gathered together sort of around him this group of ex-serving officers, and I suppose you'd have to call them strange people. Well, some were strange, some were not. They really perceived that what they were doing was something patriotic, because they saw you had the government of New South Wales at that point under Jack Lang, who was a very strong, fiery character, was faced with the Bank of England, and a guy called Niemeyer, I think, came out and told him what to do, demanding that the loans to Britain be paid ahead of everything else. So you couldn't cover the food for your people, you couldn't cover the infrastructure costs or anything like that. The loans to England meant more than anything else. And what Lang essentially did was put a moratorium on the payments of the loans and spent the money on other things, like the Sydney Harbour Bridge, like the Lang Strip roads. They'd instead of getting the dole, you would be paid to go and work on the roads. And the concept was the labour was nothing, because there'd been this depression of labour, and the raw materials were very cheap. The cement, etc., was very low, and that they would build roads out of cement that for the future. So, in other words, his concept was that we've got these people who need to be occupied, who need the dignity of work,
need to be paid,
and so that they can feed their families. We've got these infrastructure projects that we could do, and we'll do them. And I can remember personally, sort of until I think the 1960s, no, it might have even been the 1970s or 80s, certainly the road to the west out around just near Wallerawang was still a Lang Road. Mm. And by this stage you knew it was a Lang Road because it was concrete, and so you'd be driving on tar and suddenly you'd have concrete, usually patched with tar, which wasn't real good. But the major problem with these roads by that stage was that they were built for 1930s vehicles. So in other words, they were nowadays you couldn't drive on them because you couldn't drive at a reasonable speed. The camber wasn't right. The road was too tight around. You know, like it was all right if you were on an old Shep 4, bang 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 along these roads. It was great, but they were built for the future. And if you think about it, sort of from the 1930s to the 1980s, these roads did serve a substantial purpose. And, of course, built out of concrete, a long stretch of the Hume Highway South was built this way.
De Groot, though, was he actually opposed to the New Guard guys
didn't oppose this. They felt that in effect, by repudiating the British loans, and it was disloyal, it was disobedient. They had messages from the King, for all good intents and purposes, they did, saying something had to be done about this man. And you had sort of, at the time, the fascists in both Italy and Germany did not have the bad name that they ultimately got. At that point, to people who didn't know what they were looking at, they thought that these guys were probably doing the right thing, that they were disciplining the people, giving the people something to live for that was good and wholesome, like military service and saluting flags and running around and even doing nation building. And that and built on authority, built on the fact that this mob rule, this democracy thing that was always a bit of a worry, didn't happen under the fascists.
So how close, you know, accepting those kind of, in a way, yeah, ideological connections between the New Guard here and what was happening somewhere else, how close were the links between the New Guard and the Light Horse?
And the army, very strong. Mm. We're told that, not a lot of it's documented, but it's fairly certain that most of the officer corps were members of the New Guard. Because they were
most of the officer corps of the army,
of the army and the Light Horse, it's interestingly enough, whilst as a permanent soldier, you're not allowed to be a member of a party. As a part-time soldier, you've always been able to. Mm. So they were members of political parties, and they supported the New Guard. And from documents that they've got, it was perceived that the regiments would turn out on the orders of Campbell if he wanted them. You had, however, around the time, this time of the bridge and ultimately the defeat of the Lang government, some quite interesting aspects of buffoonery around the New Guard, who, whilst they may have had links to the part-time, the militia, some of the buffoon-like things they did were really quite strange. They, at one stage, they were going to kidnap Jack Lane, and but the intelligence was that bad that they knew about it. So the New South Wales police knew that they were going to kidnap the Premier. And on the night the kidnap was to take place, they simply sent his car home a different way. And he lived at, he was a real estate agent, I think, out at Auburn was Lane. And he just didn't use Parramatta Road. He drove some other way around. And that was enough to sort of get around this grand buffoonery of it. It was quite an amazing thing that although this thing was very strong, although this thing was very, very intense, we had the aspect of De Groot joining the guard, and there was a Lancer Guard formed for the Governor-General Sir Isaac Isaacs at the opening of the Sydney Harbour Bridge. And they were light horsemen, but they were wearing the... they had the ceremonial bits where they had their nice uniform, grown up the top. They had a white aigulette, which is a sort of a, you see general's aides
sort of
wear
drapery,
but it was white, yeah, mm, white ropey drapery.
Ropey, drapey,
yeah.
Mm.
And they carried the lance with the red and white pennant, and of course their slouch hat with the emu plume, so they were quite magnificent. And they used to form guards for by this stage, the dignitaries in vehicles, in cars. And the interesting part there is that actually took quite a bit. I was involved in a guard we did in 1985, and we did the centenary of the regiment, and we had light horsemen on parade. And I remember one of the old guys, a guy called Alan Bowley, who'd been part of the guard as a corporal. Alan trained the horses so that they could work with the cars, because apparently horses didn't like the way that the cars moved and things like that. And of course, if a car backfired, the horse would shy. And in those days, cars did backfire, even though they might be Rolls Royces, they still backfired. But they were... The guard there to Sir Isaac Isaacs, and De Groot came in behind it. He was reputed to... he was wearing his uniform, which anyone who was a soldier would have seen that it wasn't the right uniform. But as a civilian, you wouldn't necessarily. He was wearing his Irish Hussars uniform, not the uniform that the Light Horse were wearing. He's reputed to have tagged onto the back of the guard, and that the soldiers did not detect his presence. I've spoken to the commander of the guard, one Philip Vernon, and he says that at the time, the first thing that he knew was that this fellow on an unkempt horse raced past him and cut the ribbon. And that's, so he'd come in on the back of the guard, quite reasonably, I suppose. If you look at guards and things like that, you see people on horseback, and sometimes they're wearing slightly different uniform because they could be a staff officer or something like that. The fact that the horse was unkempt would have been a giveaway to those who were watching, I suppose. As people
it was a borrowed horse.
Yeah, as people in those days would have understood these things. To us nowadays, a horse is a horse, but in those days they would have understood. And anyway, he broke away and went and cut the ribbon. Now, I'm told, and this is the aspect of sort of the extent of the New Guard's influence and integration with the military, that when they returned to Victoria Barracks, the young lads who were, of course, probably a bit roisterous, had ribbon-cutting competitions where they set up ribbons between a couple of the guys, and someone would play De Groot and come hammering down and cut the ribbon to everyone's amusement. Mm. And that was done in the afternoon afterwards.
You did also tell me that in a political sense, there tended to be people to the right of the spectrum, like De Groot, who were attracted to the light horse and the lances.
Well, and to the army.
And to the army in general.
If you looked at the guys who came out of World War One, there were the likes of Bert Jacker, who became the mayor of St Kilda, and he was definitely to the left of centre, probably the most brilliant leader that we've ever produced. But you had
other... He was unusual, you're saying.
Well, he'd also been... He started off... He was a Lance Corporal when he got his VC. You had other guys like Cox, who'd been CO of the regiment and commander of brigade in World War One, became a senator for the... I think by that stage the Nationals, because they'd... That sort of formed this national party with the rump that had broken away from the Labor Party under Billy Hughes when he split it under conscription. You had Pompey Elliott, who was by far and away the best tactician of World War One, and I don't think that anyone would question that. He wasn't by any means the most political manoeuvrer as a soldier. But he was an MP on the right of politics. Sadly, he used his time in Parliament to attack. He'd felt he'd been badly done by the military in World War One, and spent his time in Parliament attacking those people who were at this point guys like Brunel White, who were CGS, Commander, Chief of the General Staff, etc., attacking them in Parliament. Very strange, and you had generally, I suppose, this aspect of the right side of politics, or at least those who bothered to go into politics after the war. There were, of course, many who of the left of politics who fought in the war, and some served later in political things, but. It seemed to me more that the right of politics were the guys who were there.
Now, it wasn't actually long after all these events that the unit was actually dehorsed,
yes.
The term you used, which is probably a suitable point at which our interest here will end,
right.
Because my project is about horses. Yeah. But when did that happen and what were the circumstances?
Well, the circumstances were that you had, like, in the 1920s, horses, there were fewer horses. By the middle of the 1930s, and it was 1936 when that thing happened, city boys didn't ride anymore. It was an evolution. Not every city boy could afford a car, but by geez, those who could did. there'd been this evolutionary change to the point where young men had cars instead of horses. And in 1936, a number of the regiments were dehorsed, in particular the one here in Sydney, in Melbourne. The guys up in the Hunter River were dehorsed as well. And they became mechanised machine gun regiments. They became regiments that fought from trucks as they had fought from horses. They were guys who you joined the army with your truck as opposed to joining the army with your horse, and so you were paid an allowance for your truck. You were given a coat of paint. Your truck was painted green, and it became an army truck, but it was still your truck. So it might be your truck that you used for a building site, it might be your truck that you used to deliver meat in or something like that. And they generally did things like convert, well, that one, make an ambulance. So they pulled all the meat hooks and they made an ambulance out of it. You could join with your car. You were, at this point, it was the more the better off who had the car, but they would join with their cars, etc. And they would become staff cars. And you got pictures of the regiment with all these strange vehicles. And they had no concept then of sort of any, like, once the war started, that you had to do something like uniformity, because you couldn't have the number of spares that you'd need to bring up if you had to have breakdowns and you needed to repair if you had everyone with a different vehicle. Horses didn't matter because all the horses were the same, but suddenly you had all these different vehicles. It was quite interesting. But the light horse itself continued. If you look at what happened with the Sydney unit, it was split, created Royal in 1935, so it actually was Royal before it lost its horses. In 1936, the squadrons down in Bury, or the squadron down in Bury, that was taken off and became part of the 21st, reformed 21st Light Horse. And the regiment became the first machine gun regiment, Royal New South Wales Lancers by this stage. And so the country guys still retained their horses, and the trucks were not seen as anything other than a replacement for the horse. They were a mobile replacement of the horse. You would still fight on foot, having been manoeuvred there by your truck. The light horse per se continued through until about 42. Through this period, there's a picture upstairs of a lot of the light horse camps were conducted out at Walgrove near the light horse interchange, and that's during the 1930s. The country units would come down and were based there. And interestingly enough, the last reference I saw to De Groot in the Australian Army was that, of course, he joined the army during the war, unlike the fascists in England who were still under a cloud. And he was a major at Walgrove, and there's a reference there of sort of running into Major De Groot at Walgrove Army Camp. So
that was the end of light horse?
Of horse-mounted units, basically, in the Australian Army,
yes,
1942.
Right. Yeah. And so were some actually active during the war? World War II?
No, they were active, but they never fought. Every unit, and there was only one unit with a light horse heritage that actually, or the two that fought, the 20th Light Horse fought as a pioneer battalion, and the 1st Light Horse fought as a tank regiment. And they fought dismounted. In 42, they dismounted all the light horse. They, at that stage, of course, Australia was under threat, and for the most part, they converted them into mechanised motor regiments, they called them. They were basically armoured car regiments, and were sent across to Western Australia with the 1st Australian Armoured Division, and that was for the defence of Australia. But the light horse in Sydney, you could say, yeah, disappeared then. The last fluttering of the light horse was when we had some of the guys who'd served in the light horse pre-war who were put together back on their horses and sent over for the coronation.
Oh. So that must have looked very nice. Mm. So some of the... because that would be one of the hard things now, I suppose, for reenactments and so on, is that you've got to find horses and people who can ride them.
The reenactors of... we've got a group called the Australian Light Horse Association, and these guys do bring together the reenactors. They're reenactors. The army doesn't support them, and a bit sad there, because we tried in the regiment to have reenactment troops of troopers in the regiment a couple of times, with the army doing some form of support. Initially, we tried to do it under the carpet, of course, but the government's never been prepared to do any support of this nature. The problem, in essence, is the cost of the horse.
They're not cheap.
Yeah, a horse is not cheap, and moving a horse. Mm.
Stabled and fed.
The recent stuff that we've done with the Reserve Forces Day, and Reserve Forces Day is a day once a year, 1st of July, where there is a parade of guys who served in the Reserve Forces as opposed to the Permanent Forces. To sort of, because of the fact that until quite recently they were excluded from Anzac Day celebrations. And for some ceremonial bits and pieces, we did some anniversaries that had a light horse background, and we got the light horse groups together and trained them out at Malabar, out at the old rifle range there, and then put them through the city. But these guys, some are serving soldiers, but they're all really people who just do it as a hobby. All ages, male and female, so you can find girls up there and you have to look very closely. Oh, that's pretty young.
They wouldn't have been girls years ago.
And it'll be a young lady.
And there is about to be... Is there a monument...
Yes. There's the Desert Mountain Corps monument at... it's called Shakespeare Place. It's a monument to the horses who did not return. And Shakespeare Place is just outside the New South Wales State Library. So if you come out the Mitchell Library part, and there's the sort of the road there in the middle of the road, there's all the scholars. And then on the northern part of the road is where this monument is.
And it's more or less an entrance to the botanical gardens.
Yes, it's to the entrance to the botanical gardens, got the World War II monument there, and this is off to the right of it. If you... this year is the 90th anniversary of the charge at Beersheba, and that was... our last successful cavalry charge, though not our last charge. There were successful cavalry charges in the world afterwards. There's a question of whether or not there was a cavalry charge, because they were light horsemen at the time. After that, they were issued with swords and became cavalry again. So during the 1930s, they had swords, as well as being light horse, they were also cavalrymen, and they trained as cavalrymen, and they got the guidons that I showed you. They only got guidons because they were cavalry. They weren't entitled to them before then. British wouldn't give us guidons before then. But it's the 90th anniversary of that charge, which was a pretty amazing thing, and not necessarily... Our Sydney guys, not a lot of Sydney guys in that, because the two units that took part in that were the 4th Light Horse, the ones that didn't go to France, from Melbourne, and the 12th Light Horse from the Hunter Valley. And so there's going to be a ceremony there, I think, at the end of October, where there'll be a little plaque added to that memorial to the horses that didn't come back.
I'm rapidly running out of recording but I just wanted to... There are three things. I'm just wondering if you can give me just a very quick summary of the more recent name changes.
Oh, yeah. Okay. The regiment was the 1st Machine Gun Regiment, Royal New South Wales Lancers. In 1942, when it was given tanks, it was given infantry tanks. bit hard to explain. But and so therefore managed to get the title of 1st Army Tank Battalion, Royal New South Wales Lancers.
And
later, it was accepted that a tank regiment was a tank regiment. And so it became the 1st Armoured Regiment, Royal New South Wales Lancers. In 1949, it was decided to form a permanent armoured regiment, and the title 1st Armoured Regiment was wanted for that, and so the regiment became the 1st Royal New South Wales Lancers. In 1956, the Northern Rivers Lancers, the 15th Northern Rivers Lancers, which carried traditions from the Camel Corps in World War I, was disbanded, as they disbanded a number of units in 1956, and the regiment became the 1st 15th Royal New South Wales Lancers, and that's what it is today.
That's what it remains.
Yeah, it was a tank regiment with originally Matilda tanks after the war, then Centurion tanks, then an armoured reconnaissance regiment with M113A1s, and now virtually it's an armoured reconnaissance regiment in training, but we can't afford anything for it to drive on other than the Land Rovers. So, yeah, that's what it's got.
I also wanted to mention that just yesterday or the day before, an Australian soldier was killed in Afghanistan. I think his name is
Pierce.
And he was Trooper Pierce. And what was his unit?
Okay, the 2nd, 14th, Queens... Light Horse, 2nd 14th Light Horse, Queensland Mounted Infantry. The 2nd Light Horse was formed in Queensland, in Brisbane, in exactly the same way as our unit with the traditions based in Brisbane. The 14th was the other unit that came from the Camel Corps. So it had a Camel Corps condition. During World War II, it was not sent anywhere. It was not formed and sent anywhere. After World War II, it was a militia regiment in Queensland until the latter part of the 1990s. It had a regular squadron. One of its regular squadrons had gone to Vietnam. It had that regular squadron had gone to Vietnam. It became a regular regiment in the 1990s. So, in other words, it was converted into from a militia regiment with light horse tradition into a regular regiment with light horse tradition, and so that guy there, doing exactly the same job as a driver of a light armoured vehicle, doing exactly the same job as a light horseman would have done. In World War One.
And what we haven't talked about is your own connections with the army. You've obviously we've only got about 3 minutes here, but I guess what interests me is that you, I think you started in reserve forces.
No, I started a university student, joined the University of New South Wales Regiment when I was at uni. Then was posted to the New South Wales, Royal New South Wales Lancers. Now it'd be straight away, but in those days I'd graduated and I think I was a captain before I was actually posted here. And train as a captain, the bottom up, because that's the way they teach army. You know, like, first thing I had to do was go and do a driving course. That's how they teach you. Then through until the 1980s, 1985, I left the regiment. I'd been to OC the regiment in 1985, and I was posted away on promotion. And, I left the army. I was retired from the army in 1995 at the age of 50, which in those days they did that now. Now, actually, if circumstances had been different, I'd gone on to the inactive reserve sort of a year or so before to finish my master's degree. And if circumstances had been a little bit different and I'd actually stayed in, I could probably have stayed on now. But I don't know whether or not I'd have wanted to.
Nevertheless, you've obviously got a great passion for the history.
Oh yeah,
that
yeah.
preceded.
Yeah,
you.
Yeah. Well, that I think that that's something that happens to a certain extent all soldiers. I always had a bit of a passion for history. I think I'd mentioned that I'd worked as an archivist for a number of years. And so I'd had a passion for history, but I think it's something that all soldiers have. As you see the museum, it's here, and you met Ross Brown, who's the historian. Well, Ross was my second in command when I was the OCB squadron here. And Ross is now retired from, he was someone up in the state emergency organisation of the state government, and has retired now, and spends his Thursdays here ensuring that the collection is looks okay.
And it's a wonderful collection, and it actually looks marvellous. It's beautifully presented and beautifully maintained.
And the other thing I do is I run the website, but that's because I like doing websites. But that's beside the point.
That's very modern and a long way from the original Light Horse.
Well, a bit, but I don't know.
So, John Hales, thanks very much.
Thank you.